Hello, everyone. This is Frank Vignone, and you are listening to Water Cooler Chats. I'm the Southern Gay Italian Dyslexic Dumpster Diver, and today I have a friend of mine, Gary Sandling. He's Vice President of Visitor Programs and Services at the Thomas Jefferson Foundation. And for those of you that don't know, that's Monticello. He also has another hat, which is President of the Virginia Association of Museums. And so, Gary, you're all over the place, and I'm so glad that you were able to take some time and talk with me today.
Thanks for the invite, Frank. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Now, I know you, but I don't think everyone else may who's listening. Can you give me some words or phrases that define who you are in terms of culture, social situation, ethnicity, things like that?
Yeah, sure. Like I often, I think for a long time, my kind of shorthand for that is to say, I am an eighth-generation Southerner, white male Southerner who grew up 50 miles to the closest mall and 120 to the nearest major airport. So I grew up in a really rural place on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee near the Mississippi River. And that's often how I start that kind of conversation. Because that background, I think, has had a lot to do with kind of where I see the kind of contributions I can make this career, this accidental career of working in a museum. I was training as an academic historian, and then sort of slid into for various reasons into working in a kind of public history field. So, but that background is one that I think has informed a lot of my thinking.
And talk to me a little bit about that. How that background, maybe being more rural, maybe being that in between state. Kind of socially, I don't know economically, but talk to me about how that's helped you or hurt you in the museum field.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think it's informed what I do in the sense that, I grew up in a place that was very much out of the kind of cultural zeitgeist of the U.S., and I grew up in a place that was fairly poor. I didn't realize it was poor when I grew up. My parents were both middle-class people. They were the first people in their families to go to college. So, I mean, I was very fortunate in my upbringing, but I didn't realize how poor where I grew up was until I left it. But I grew up in a place that's still very much defined, even right now, by kind of issues of black and white and by issues of race. And again, something that I was much more, you're sort of keyed into in a place like that as a child in a variety of ways without it being this kind of
intellectual state.
Without the intellectual constructs,
yeah.
That's right. And kind of that process of thinking about that experience as I went to college and then, went to graduate school. And I did, in between those two things, the Teach for America program back mm-hmm. when it first existed, 20 plus years ago, and taught in a very rural place. Coming to terms with ideas about race and racism and racial identity in America and how the history of early America is a really powerful lens for that.
And talk to me a little bit about growing up in this kind of environment, this rural environment. How was society around you in terms of racism, and how has that affected your view of racism?
That's a good question. I think a world where, in the rural South, there's always a lot of discussion about, personal, there's often, discussion about, where it's kind of that thing where in your own personal experience, you can say, there's... some of my best, the kind of that line where some of my best friends are black, right? People talk about these personal relationships being very powerful between, amongst people of different races, which is true, but it doesn't sort of preclude the idea that there's still this sort of systematic discrimination that happens and a kind of separateness. That separateness, I think, growing up was powerful. And it was sort of there. No one really talked that much about it.
And then here you've landed kind of in a way the bullseye kind of socially and historically in the United States at Monticello that is at least it's transforming into the dialogue, the discussion about race because of the Hemings Jefferson situation. Is that behind us? Is that something that's still happening at Monticello, the discussion about the slavery issue and things like that?
I think so. Monticello for, since, I would say, since about 1990 has really been trying to tackle the issue of how you interpret slavery and to understand the lives of people enslaved at Monticello as a lens. You know, think of Monticello not just as a house, but as a plantation. And so I came to it in 2005 in a time where that dedication to sort of that research and to how to interpret and understand that research had been very much underway and still going on. But the question of the paternity of Sally Hemings' children, whether Jefferson fathered them, you know, in some ways for a lot, what I think a number of scholars would tell you is, yes, that's kind of old news. But I think in the American discourse about race and about slavery, this is still this story is very powerful, and it still can provoke controversy. For us, it's a jumping off point to talk about the lives of enslaved people here in some ways independent of Jefferson. So in other words, this story can be a way to sort of begin that discussion, because this family, when we talk about the Hemings family, we're talking about 70 or so people over three or four generations. But to talk about the arc from slavery to freedom for some of them, to talk about how they negotiate the color line, things like that are, to me, I mean, just personally, I think really important contributions for a place like this, one that's understandably viewed with some skepticism. How it talks about
now, so I've got two slavery. Questions. One is, what's that like being, as you describe yourself, the straight white male who's actually working on the programs to expand the African-American slave narrative at Monticello? And then the second question is, do you find that a lot of the people coming to the site are not nearly as aware of the story as perhaps people in the museum feel?
So I think first, you know, thinking about, there's certainly, I think, you know, kind of as someone who's in a position of being someone in the kind of dominant a group of people who have sort of defined the narrative, you know, for a long time. You know, I think there's certainly a recognition that comes with its own biases and assumptions that we have to figure out how to work through and work out and include a greater perspective of voices and how we fashion that narrative. But I also think it's a story that, you know, I think that the story of understanding this is also helping people who don't think about it much. You know, a lot of people would self-identify as, I mean, this is generalizing a bit, but, you know, people who self-identify as white, for whom thinking about slavery is kind of a, you know, I can think about what I want to, and then I can just put it, you know, I could put something like that over here in a box when I don't want to. Those kinds of questions.
And you really can't do that at Monticello. It's really
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I mean, the intention is to say, you know, you can't understand Jefferson without understanding Monticello, and you can't understand Monticello without understanding that it's a plantation worked primarily, overwhelmingly, by enslaved labor. And you can't, to me, you can't stand, you know, in a place where, you know, over the course of Jefferson's lifetime, hundreds of enslaved people walked, lived, worked. You can't stand there and look around and it would be, and for us to not, you know, ground everyone in that context.
Yeah.
Now, so when people come, you know, they come with a lot, you know, people come, as you know, and your listeners know, people come to historic sites freighted with a whole set of assumptions about their experience, right? And those are informed by, you know, what they've learned, but also about what they've felt and experienced, you know, personally. And so, you know, for some who come here, the fact that we talk about slavery at all is, it bothers them, or they complain it's too much. We're actually doing some survey work right now to sort of assess what the perception of our visitors are about the ways we talk about slavery and the how much we talk about it. And it's interesting, even using a term like enslaved can sometimes, you know, people will disparage, you know, that choice, which might be kind of surprising, because they'll say, well, you're just, you know, you're just using this over and over and over to enforce their status, to which, you know, we say, yes, you know, we are trying to enforce that, because the Monticello is a plantation that has a lot of enslaved labor. So I think there's still, I think a lot of folks who come to, so places like Monticello, which are these, have traditionally been these, you know, thought of as these kind of sites of civic pilgrimage, certainly for, you know, a lot of white and middle class people, you know, it still serves that function. There's still inspiration to be had in Jefferson's ideas, but they have to understand the context in which those ideas were fashioned. And that's what we, you know, you can go to a public building, like maybe, even though this is an oversimplification, you can go to a place that's not someone's home and maybe think about those ideas divorced from their day-to-day lives, right? In the same way you can think about art.
Yeah.
And not the artist. But when you're in someone's house, when you're standing on that ground, you gotta be able to think about
which
that.
Which is the power of a historic site. Let me ask you, how a lot of people say, okay, that's fine, you're trying to expand the narrative, but does your staff, do the employees, do they really represent the constituency of the individuals that you're talking about? You know, have you gone out of your way to hire people of color to help craft this narrative?
Yeah, and the short answer is no. You know, we have a lot of work to do there, but we are doing it. We mm-hmm. are involved in recruiting historians, community. We have a community engagement officer we hired this year who's in fact a descendant she's a descendant of a different member of Jefferson's White family and of the Hemings family, interestingly.
Yeah, interesting.
He's a journalist. You know, he's trained as a journalist. Mm-hmm. We recruit interpretive staff through our internship program. We look specifically when we can hire for people of color, especially. But there's more work there to be done. We have a lot more we need to do.
You know, I just interviewed...
We're developing a plan to do it, so...
And no, I just interviewed Nicole Moore, who... she has a website, Interpreting Slave Life. And we talked a lot, as did Joe McGill and I, about the importance of having African Americans actually be the first person interpreters on sites like, for instance, Monticello. We didn't actually mention Monticello, but... you know, plantation sites. And there was a little bit of disagreement even between the two whether or not the organizations need to go out of their way to hire first-person interpreters who were African-American, for instance, who were actually going to be interpreting slaves. It's a complicated issue that they both acknowledge there wasn't a clean answer for that.
Right.
One thing that I wanted to bring up with you is I think it was in the paper just a few days ago, and it's about a proposed museum in Alabama. You know, we're talking about historic sites and plantation sites that are definitely about slavery and that narrative, but this new museum in Alabama really highlights lynchings that have occurred in the United States. And so some people are dubbing it the Museum of Lynchings, but it's really about enslavement and mass incarceration in the United States. How do you see this kind of museum fitting into the larger context of, for instance, the narratives of plantations, the Whitney Plantation, Laura Plantation, what Montpelier's doing, what you're doing? How do you see that fitting in?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it, although I've read a couple of articles about it. I read the New York Times piece about it. You know, I think that story is part of that arc of how we... You know, slavery is kind of the origins of taking a group of people and making them property and oppressing them and disadvantaging them from the start has consequences throughout our history. And I think a museum that it highlights that, highlights some aspects of that is critical to understanding the overall picture. And I think, you know, even to look at, you know, there are now databases of lynchings to sort of see the scope. I was shocked, in fact, and I don't know why I was shocked, but I was shocked. You know, I learned that there had been one in the town I grew up in, and I didn't know anything about that until I was an adult. And it had been 100 years before, but it didn't matter that it was still there, and there was nothing to, you know, mark or commemorate that.
Yeah.
So I think something that helps, you know, obviously, when we think about history, you know, museums and historic sites and, you know, are there to help help us craft, you know, a memory of the past. And if something like that helps us understand the prevalence and the kind of the suffering. We had, you know, an interview with Monica Montgomery and, you know, talking about we should be seeing things about, shouldn't always be about slavery and enslavement. And I think that's absolutely right. You know, talk about the black experience in America has to be beyond that. It has to be much more than that. But I think it's pretty important for a lot of people in America who don't think about the scale and level of suffering, of oppression that happened after slavery. So you know, I think a museum like this helps us understand more fully, you know, the range of that.
Now, someone who's in the museum field actually making decisions, you know, I like to end these chats with, give me one clear thing that you or I or someone in a leadership position could do right now to forward inclusion and diversity in our museums or historic sites. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the one clear thing that any museum can do right now is to talk to the constituencies who aren't coming and whose stories are being told, and to involve them in the planning and the conversation and the creation, which is hard to do, I think, in a lot of cases for a variety of reasons. But I think for us, one of the great benefits is, you know, a little over 20 years ago, an oral history project started at Monticello called Getting Word, which is an oral history project of descendants of Monticello slaves. And that community of descendants, that group of people, have been for us in a variety of ways a really important constituency in helping us understand how we tell the story of their ancestors. And there's more work to be done there, but building that community has been important for us. And I'd say that's the one thing that, it's pretty obvious, I know, but I think that's one clear thing that anybody can make happen in a position, in any position, really.
Yeah, and you know I agree with you. It's the number one thing that historic sites can do is look outside of themselves for direction on their narrative. Thank you, Gary. This has really been great. You're really helping me kind of find the answers for these questions, and we're not going to find them if we don't speak openly and honestly about them. So thanks again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Frank.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.